Hello and welcome to the Australian Bitcoin Podcast. On today's show, we've got Fernando Nikolic with us. So Fernando is a Bitcoiner. He works at Blockstream. He runs also a newsletter talking about called Bitcoin Perception, where he discusses the perception of Bitcoin in the media. But he's also an Argentinian. Originally, he was born in Argentina, and he was kind enough to join us on very short notice to talk about the latest events in Argentina. So for those who don't know, there was an election in Argentina where Javier Milei won the election, and he's a very kind of maverick politician, very unconventional in many ways, and very kind of libertarian leaning. And a lot of people in Bitcoin are very excited about him coming to power. Some say he has a very pro-Bitcoin position. We'll try and find out about that with Fernando. So the point here is really for Fernando to explain to us who is Javier Milei and kind of what's the situation in Argentina and what it means for Bitcoin. So Fernando, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Hey, Daniel. I'm good, man. I'm happy to be here. Happy to be seated with you. And let's talk about Bitcoin Argentina for a while. That's always interesting.
Yeah. But before we get into that, for those who don't know you, I tried to give a brief intro, but I'm sure you can maybe provide a bit more information. Like, who are you and kind of what's your background in Bitcoin?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Fernando Nikolic. So I am originally from Argentina. The last name is Serbian, which is, you know, a little testament of like the European immigration that, you know, Argentines are really, you know, mostly from. I am not in Argentina right now. I left as a kid. My mom emigrated in the late 80s, in 1989, when I was a kid, because of hyperinflation. My family came to the point where being prosperous meant finding opportunities in other countries outside of Argentina. So I grew up between Argentina and Northern Europe during my childhood and my educational years. I always found it fascinating how people continued to emigrate and leave Argentina and separate from their families a long time after 1989. So that always caught my attention. I wanted to know exactly why that was the case. And I quickly found out that it was due to hyperinflation, basically. Just continuous chronic devaluation of the money that ultimately rips out the social fabric of society, but also obviously has, you know, severe economical damage to the country as a whole. So as I was studying that, I got into more of the like Austrian economics to try to find like, okay, is there any theory that is opposite of how people are convinced things are being done in Argentina? And that, you know, led me to go through the door and learn about, you know, other ways of having currency and having more of a private competition in a free market, surrounding who emits the currency that is the best that the people or the market just adopts organically. So when I then later came into Bitcoin around 2017 from a friend of mine, all that experience being up from Argentina and knowing very deeply what hyperinflation means because of my family and, you know, how my life turned out, but also with the theoretical, what the Austrian economic theory. Those two things, my experience and that theory, led me to really understand Bitcoin pretty quickly. And ever since then, I, been thinking about Bitcoin, always try to, you know, build a community around Bitcoin in my social circle. And then ultimately that led to me wanting to work in Bitcoin. So since 2021, early 2021, I became the head of marketing and communications at Blockstream. And that's what I'm doing right now. And as I lead the communications efforts of Blockstream, I have been for the past 2 years been very close to the media and how they portray Bitcoin. There's a lot of prominent people in Blockstream who appears in the mainstream media, and being closer to that led me to also create this report that I create called Bitcoin Perception, because I've learned a lot in the past 2 years about how the mainstream media perceives Bitcoin, how they cover it, how they talk about it. So I was looking for something of a report or some kind of software that could tell me a little bit about that. And since I didn't find anything, I decided to build it myself. So that's pretty much what I'm doing right now.
So going back to Argentina, so we had the election, Javier Milei won, and obviously you're Argentinian, and for any Argentinian it's going to be important, but for non-Argentinian Bitcoiners, why do they care? Like, why? What's the implications for the? Why do you think there's so much interest in this?
Well, I think that, you know, Bitcoin in itself is political. Like, a lot of people, they say like, oh, Bitcoin doesn't care. Well, Bitcoin was created or invented for a very specific reason. And I think that reason is very political. You're trying to separate money from the state, essentially. And with fiat money, with the fiat money experiment, money has been extremely politicized. So if you're trying to create something like Bitcoin and fight for its adoption and global and raise global awareness, that's ultimately a political act, the way that I see it. So, and I think a lot of people agree with me as well, because you have seen there's a faction of Bitcoiners who are very much politically inclined. They even subscribe to very specific political beliefs or ideology, call it what you want to call it. It's more about libertarianism, free market economies, more Austrian economics, and all of that stuff. For people who don't know that much, usually label that as like right-leaning ideology. It's all about, ultimately, it's about freedom and freedom from the state. So, you know, people who are very much in love with the state are usually more on the left side. So I can totally understand why that divide also happens in Bitcoin. And when somebody like Milei, who kind of like represents all of those ideals, ends up winning a presidential election in a country that is part of the G20, I understand why there's so much, you know, attention given to Milei, but also how much excitement is surrounding him. So I think that is pretty much the reason why a lot of Bitcoiners are interested in it today. But I've also seen a lot of bad takes about the election and Bitcoin's relationship with Milei, or Milei's relationship with Bitcoin specifically. So I think there's still a lot of nuance that needs to be discussed. And yeah, that's why we're here, right? To discuss that.
Right. Yeah, and I agree with you completely. There is a political aspect of Bitcoin because, I mean, we're trying to create money, and money has always been really a political thing. Going back, if you go thousands of years, the Roman emperors put the picture of their face on the coins. So money has always had like a political aspect to it. So that's definitely correct. And you know, it doesn't mean like some Bitcoiners are kind of completely against the state. Some, and you know, you can have different positions and different aspects of politics, but there is definitely a political aspect of Bitcoin, because I mean, like the money is a fundamental part of the state. At the end of the day, it's like the army, the currency, these are like the core components of a state. So trying to change what money a state uses, it is political at its core. Going to Javier Milei, like for us, a lot of people in Australia, you know, we don't know, you know, a little bit, but maybe not that much. A lot of my audience might not know all the details. So he's a libertarian candidate. Is he pro-Bitcoin? Can you explain a bit more about his kind of political philosophy and his stance on Bitcoin?
You know, all these labels are kind of like misleading, because he is, and he calls himself liberal libertario in Spanish, which is liberal libertarian. But I think liberal today means different things. I mean, liberal today, if you look at Canada and the Liberal Party, it's not at all kind of like the opposite of what Milei represents. But all these terms aside, I think Milei just ascribes to, you know, the monetary theory of the Austrians, right? He's a big fan of Mises, big fan of Hayek. He talks about Rothbard a lot. And this is kind of like how he became famous. Back in, I think in 2015, he started getting more attention. I personally discovered Millet around 2018. And what is amazing about Millet is that he has been able to synthesize the ideas of someone like Mises and, you know, human action into very succinct, very digestible, bite-sized ways of talking about it that has really penetrated the collective conscience of Argentinians. And nowadays, the only way to penetrate the collective conscious of a society is through memes or viral videos through the internet. And he did that, which is kind of amazing, because if you look at the way that people have tried to talk about Austrian economics, for example, it's very very academical. So it becomes like a, you know, mental masturbation where you really need to have read a lot just to catch the essentials. Millet turned it around and made it like, put it in a way that just people understood right away, which is such a feat in itself. But apart from that, he also had the delivery, right? He had like this execution method of like screaming at you and not caring who he was talking to, right? Like in Argentina,
when you said people understood right away, you meant people understood the, you know, the Austrian economics? Is mm-hmm. that what you, okay.
Yeah, because he didn't necessarily say, hey, guys, this is Austrian economics. Let me tell you about how that works. He was kind of like saying, you know, he was contrasting that to the reality of Argentina. So that was something that everybody could relate to because they're from Argentina. They live there. They see themselves how the Argentine peso gets devalued and how prices are going up and like life becomes impossible. So he basically said, these people who are doing that to you are evil. They use the Argentine peso as a weapon and they don't care about you. And there's other ways to do this. And that's what I represent. So he just made it very contrasted and made it very black and white. And a lot that is something that people can understand, a very complex topic quicker if you contrast it to something that they feel themselves. So he basically did that, but it also the fact that his personality is very, very careless. Like he doesn't care who you are. If you say something stupid, he's going to tell you, you just said something crazy stupid and I'm here to correct you. And in Argentina, this debate shows is very popular. So when he started kind of like going against even the hosts of these shows and just like completely just evaporated anyone who said something stupid, people were like starting to pay attention. So that was kind of like the introduction to Millet to the general populace. And then over time, you know, as his popularity grew because of these reasons that I just said, he just like put it into the next gear and started becoming political in 2019 or 2020. No, 2021, actually. So it's just the last 2 years that he has turned it into something political. But before that, he was just an economist who went on these shows and talked about his beliefs and just slowly and surely just convinced people about these beliefs. So it's a very organic, very natural way that he came into the collective consciousness of Argentinians.
I guess Argentina was in some ways a fertile ground for these ideas with its high inflation and economic issues. But yes, I think part of the excitement is basically to see someone in a major economy with that Austrian school of economics thinking. Because explain for the audience, for those who are not familiar, really, we could say in the last 50 years, 50 or 60 years, there were really two schools, the kind of Keynesian school and the Austrian school. And really, the last 30 or 40 years, pretty much everywhere in the world, the Keynesian school has dominated. And in a nutshell, tell me if you disagree, but in a nutshell, I would explain the Keynesian school as believing you need to control, that the government needs to control the supply of money to smooth out the economic cycles. So you have less harsh recessions and you don't have these crazy booms. That's how it's supposed to work in theory, where the Austrian school says that you really shouldn't control the supply of money, but it should be constant and reliable, but you need good kind of money. The government should not interfere in the supply of money. And really, Bitcoin is an implementation of that Austrian school. So that Austrian school, like Bitcoin comes out of that Austrian school. That's what it is. That's its key point. You can't control the supply of money. So even if somebody doesn't know anything about Bitcoin, simply to have that kind of Austrian school of money be more prominent, and to have a politician of a major country like come to power with an Austrian school, that's already an exciting and significant event. Because yeah, it's really everywhere in the world right now, it's dominated by that Keynesian thinking. But I think a lot of people are starting to see the issues with that Keynesian, because it sounds good in theory, but in practice, politicians, they're not disciplined in controlling that supply of money, and they just, while in theory it works great, in reality there's always the temptation for governments and politicians to increase that supply of money more than what is justified. So that's why it really values.
The temptation is also very, very big when you are in a industrious country like Argentina with a lot of natural resources, and you can tap into a lot of money from that, but also it's a culture thing as well. Like, it's just so be it that Argentinian culture is very much corrupt, in the sense that it's all about like who's the smartest, who's the best at backstabbing, who's the one who can fool the system and do the most shortcuts and get away with things. So it's a combination of a lot of things, but ultimately, Keynesian philosophy is all about that, like, you need to insert more money into circulation for the economy to, like, you know, live or exist or go through these like bursts where there's a lot of prosperity for everyone. You need to like create money, put it into circulation, and that's how it works, without like disregarding the Cantillon effect or anything like that, right? It's like a huge flawed theory, but that theory is also very good for more like leftist politicians, because they're all their discourse is about putting more money in your pocket, right? So if they kind of like say, hey, we need to do this because otherwise you won't have more money in your pocket, a lot of people are going to say, well, yeah, I do want more money in my pocket. Yes, so I will vote you. So it's a very sneaky way for like more socialist, more left-leaning, hardcore left-leaning politicians to take that and put that into their narratives to get power and to get votes. And that's exactly what has happened in Argentina since the 40s, 50s, when, you know, Perón came to power. He was not a leftist per se. He was like a military general, but he was very inspired by Mussolini and Franco and the fascism regimes in Europe at that time. He traveled there and got inspired and saw how it worked. And the thing about fascism is that a lot of people say fascism is like a right-leaning thing. There's really no real difference between fascism and communism, which is supposed to be the most extreme on both sides. Ultimately, what both fascists and communists want is complete state control. And the thing that Perón did was he took the fascist business model, which is actually what takes the government as a business, where everything is owned by the state, but still works as a efficient or at least try to be efficient company. Whereas communism is kind of like, we don't really care if things is not really efficient. We just put more money into circulation and we pay everybody. But Perón did that as a business model inspired by the fascists. But then in his rhetoric, he implements a lot of leftist rhetoric. So he kind of like sold to the Argentine people the illusion of the welfare state, social justice, all of that stuff, right? So he kind of like it's a genius move in a way, right? He took best of both worlds and then put it into Argentina. And the thing is that survived for so long that it is engraved in the culture right now after so many decades, where if you want to become successful, you need to be a state employee. And if you can't be a state employee, well, you need to live off the state. You need to, get all the plans, get all the social security, you need to get like prices subsidized and so forth. So that has created a culture where you're either dependent on the state or you use the state to get ahead. And that has like destroyed Argentina and everything that Argentina was before Perón came into power. And we're talking about 80 years now. And this is the thing that Milei has been saying, like, we have done this terrible experiment with so-called Peronism for 80 years. And look at us now, 50% of the entire population lives under the poverty line, 10% are homeless, not knowing where the next meal is going to come from. We have a mass exodus of people. We have the massive brain drain. All the good talent is outside of Argentina, et cetera, and et cetera. So I think this is the time where, these type of leftist, extreme, Keynesian tactics have come to die. And somebody like Milei takes that opportunity to rise and to kind of like try to steer Argentina in the opposite direction.
Right. So yeah, Perón was socially conservative and kind of patriotic nationalist, conservative. I'm guessing probably also Christian, from a social perspective, but economically his policies were very left wing. Which is, yeah, like you said, it's kind of, I mean, if you look at the name of the Nazis, it's the National Socialists. So it was that right. Kind of idea. They were nationalists, but they had implemented the kind of a socialist left-wing program. So I guess his philosophy, I'm guessing probably not as quite as extreme as the Nazis, but it was kind of like a moderated version. Okay, but it has, and so it seems like that has that idea, like maybe compelling, hasn't worked for Argentina. But I'm curious, is Perón, like during your lifetime, is he still seen by both people of like left-wing and right-wing people in Argentina? Was he still seen as a very positive figure? As a kind of like, I'm curious about, how people look at Perón.
Yeah, so this is a very good question. Perón,
do you like him?
I don't like him. I think that if you look at Perón's history and kind of like his time as he had several terms as a president in Argentina throughout his time. There's kind of like very different things that happened, but I think the most important, the interesting thing is what happened in this last tenure, because he eventually grew so big that different factions within the so-called Peronist movement started to appear, and basically was right wing and left wing factions within the Peronist movement that started fighting against each other, which happened in the 70s. Ultimately, Perón was exiled and he lived in Spain during Franco's regime for about 12 or 13 years, if I remember correctly. So he had to leave the country. And when he came back in the early 70s, the two factions, the right wing and the left wing factions of Peronists, had grown so big themselves that they both wanted to take over and be in power. Perón, though, had a very famous speech where both of these factions were gathered in the Plaza de Mayo.
Can I interrupt? And when you say these factions, were they split on the economical aspect or on the social aspect?
More about the social.
Both economically, they were both left-wing kind of socialist.
Yeah, I think that there were no economical you know, ideology that was dominant. It was mostly the usual Cold War, you know, communism versus capitalism that, you know, many, many countries in Latin America in the 70s, 60s, 80s, they have their own stories as well, right? Where the US intervened in many elections, and there was they were supporting a lot of anti-communist you know, movements within each country. In Argentina, there was no difference. The more left-wing Peronist movements called Montoneros, those are like the more famous one, but there was also different factions within that as well. They were straight up terrorists. So they bombed buildings, they killed innocent people. And all of that led to Perón, in a famous speech, he kind of like said that he expelled them from the plaza. So that ultimately ended in more violence. Even when Perón had come back from Spain and landed in the airport, there were some shootouts between these factions as well. So it's a very tumultuous time for Argentina that ultimately led to, in 1976, a military dictatorship that was installed until 1983. So what I'm trying to say with all of this is that Peronism today, it depends a lot when who you talk to, but a lot of these later leftist governments, like the one that is exiting right now that lost to Milei, they use Perón's face, they use Evita's face, they use a lot of the romanticism of Perón and Evita in their political campaigns. But it's very contradictory because they totally forget that dude was inspired by Franco and Mussolini. And they talk about, like, you know, they talk about like a lot of they adopt a lot of the, like, the woke ideas of like LGBTQ rights, identity politics and stuff like that, that I know that Perón, if he was alive today, he would just totally be against that. So Perón's image, to answer your question, and sorry, it's a little rant because it's such a complex history. It's Perón's image has been distorted in a way. But I think a lot of the people who like Perón today, who also like Cristina Kirchner, who also subscribe to the so-called Kirchnerism period that started in 2003 and has been, you know, one of Milei's biggest political promises, that I want to defeat Kirchnerism. They governed 16 out of the last 20 years, and is a big reason of the decadence that happened in Argentina. A lot of people who subscribe, who like Cristina Kirchner, who like that type of movement with all the LGBTQ rights and all the identity politics and the kind of like the woke left, they love Perón today. I would say that there's a lesser and lesser group of people who subscribe to that movement who also love Perón, and that they really see how much damage that actually cost Argentina and are starting to think differently about Perón, especially the younger generation today.
Yeah, right. I guess it's kind of similar. We're in a lot of places, but like everybody looks at America, and in America, most people kind of look to, you know, the founding fathers, like we talk about the founding fathers in America, but like the left wing and the right wing. But I think some of those like policies, but some, especially of those left wing people in United States advocate and exactly kind of probably the wasn't really the moral philosophy of the founding fathers, right? Of America.
Exactly.
But that's kind of, yeah, but that's going off topic a bit. But yeah, going back to Argentina, and I think something I'm sure you're aware of, but a lot of people are not, is that Argentina historically used to be a pretty wealthy country before that Peronist period. And I'm guessing even at the start of that Peronist period, it was considered a pretty wealthy country. Some say like around the turn of a century or around 100 years ago, like some figures that it was close to similar to the wealth of the United States per capita. And obviously that's why, you know, you say you're Serbian and background, and obviously there's a lot of Italians in Argentina, and always Europeans came to Argentina presumably because it was reasonably wealthy and they could have a better life in Argentina than they could in Europe. And I just wanted, I think that's is my understanding correct there? And I think it kind of really has gone downhill a bit in the last 50 years. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that is exactly right. A lot of these immigrants who went to Europe, they at the same time also went to New York, right? So it was kind of like big wave of immigrants from Europe going to New York and Buenos Aires around the same time. I think the biggest like boat lines were from Europe to New York or Buenos Aires, to be honest. And it was a wave of immigrants who were, escaping extreme poverty in Europe, but also they also came to work, right? So they were, these immigrants who came to New York and Buenos Aires, they were there to build a nation. I guess the U.S. was a little bit more developed at that time. I think the U.S. have about 100 more years in Argentina in terms of independence. But still, they all came to work and they were part of building a great nation, both Argentina and the U.S. And the decadence that happened after, well, that is a testament of the saying, like, it's easier to destroy things than to build things, right? So with all that building, all that great architecture, all the businesses, all the things that was created out of sheer necessity, there was straight up old school capitalism, right? You offer a product or service to your next kin for a better price or a better quality. And all of that just made Argentina great. But I guess, greed took over, and also very easy when you have it good to start thinking about, other stuff that doesn't matter. You see a lot of like developed nations in the West today, they have become a victim to a lot of these policies that are altruistic, but ultimately comes from a place where you have it so good that you forget about we need to build, we need to prosper, we need to make things better. It's kind of like you come to a point where things are so good that your focus is elsewhere. And I think in Argentina's case, there was so much money all over the country in so many different industries that the cultural aspect of, what I just said took over. The corruption took over, because ultimately, the majority of immigrants who came to Argentina were Italian, Spanish. They came from poor countries, ultimately. So I would say that when you come from a very poor mindset and you run into a lot of money very fast, the corruption is not only in the politics, but it's also in the mind and the culture. And I think, unfortunately, people like Perón and his comrades, they took that as an opportunity and took over the country because it was so much money, so much resources to take over. And that's kind of like where it all went down. Before that, we had leaders like Alberti, Roca, who were more, they were just thinking about the country and not themselves. So I don't know if this is more also like a testament of how humanity kind of like developed into the early 20th century. But I believe like in the late 19th century, 20th century, there was more pride, more honor, in the work of being a leader or, a politician that is supposed to be a leader of a country. That may have happened, something that created Perón. I don't know.
I definitely think so. I think there was this kind of, before you go back in time, I do believe there was we had a kind of stronger sense, I don't know, maybe of community or maybe of belonging. I think there is this kind of, more and more there's this culture where in the world where everybody's kind of out, like just looking after themselves. And I think maybe just people don't feel like they belong as much as they did before. So they don't have that sense of belonging to something, where they put something higher than themselves. These days, most people, like, they don't see anything higher. And it's not kind of to say people are selfish, but I think, like, it just, we don't see anything, but there's nothing to really kind of to aspire to, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Nothing to, like, really look at what's higher. So there's nothing for me to, everything doesn't look that great. So I might as well just look after myself and my family, because what else am I going to put above that? But yeah, like, some of those things you are saying, I think many Australians would probably recognize as happening here. Maybe we're not as quite bad situation as Argentina is, but, you know, in Australia, we call it the lucky country, because Australia does have a lot of things going for it. We're a pretty big country with a small population, a lot of resources, and a lot of kind of natural wealth. So it does have a lot of things going for it, but that kind of wealth also, people take it a bit for granted, I think. And everybody thinks things will always keep on going, and like, the money never runs out and we're always going to be wealthy. But if you don't look after it, and Argentina is kind of an example of that. It used to be pretty wealthy, and it's not quite as wealthy as it was. And now in Australia, again, it's not a terrible situation, but if you look at, especially for the younger generation, people in their 20s and early 30s, the prospects, economic prospects, aren't quite as good as they were for the generation 20 or 30 years ago. So, it might be kind of a useful example to learn for us here, Argentina. And I think something I heard, tell me if this is correct or not, but I saw it on Twitter, so it's probably not correct, but I think, because you know how Twitter is, but apparently what I heard is that I think every second employee in Argentina is employed in the public sector.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly the numbers, but they are like crazy like that. These numbers are probably crazy. I remember there's an economist in Argentina called Roberto Kachanovsky, who kind of like went viral a couple of years ago when he was comparing the amount of politicians in the state versus the amount of politicians in the Spanish state, so in the country of Spain. And I think there was Argentina and Spain have almost the same population, so it's around 45 million people living in Spain and Argentina approximately. So he was saying, like, for every Spanish politician, there's three Argentinian politicians to manage the exact same amount of people. So it was a very, back to the contrast that I was talking about. You put something that is Argentinian and you contrast it to something from another country, and you can really tell how messed up it is in Argentina. So he said something like that. That was exactly about the point that you just said. There's so many public employees in Argentina, it's ridiculous. I think the flagship airline, Aerolíneas Argentinas, have about four times or maybe five times more employees than United Airlines, four times more than the Brazilian one, which is also pretty bad. I mean, Brazil, still a country in South America, has a socialist government, but they privatized their airlines, their national airline, the flagship airline. So stuff like that, you can go forever and you can find a list of, like, okay, you know, employees in the public TV and media company, compare that to, the biggest media outlet in Australia. And you're going to see there's like five times more people in the Argentine company than Australia. So when you compare these, like, huge television and media communication, public transportation, airlines, companies that are built off the national resources like oil and gas, all of these things that are public, compare that to any privatized company that is exactly the same in any successful country, and you'll see Argentina has five times, six times more employees in these companies rather than the one that are private. So that is what Milei is trying to say. Like, he's about austerity, and he says there's no money left in Argentina. We need to cut down on the costs. But his main campaign was this cost that we are going to take away are not going to be taken away from the people. It's going to be taken away from the public sector, from these politicians, and their cronies who have just enjoyed decades of like frivolous spending because they work in the public sector. Milei is here to say that I'm going to take away all your rights. You won't have access to these grants and these crazy budgets from the state budget. You're just going to find out for yourself how profitable you can be, and you're going to be forced to be competitive, and you're going to be privatized. So this is kind of like the things that he wants to do, and it's one of the few kind of like talking points in his campaigns that ultimately led to his victory. The reduction of these like public sector useless parasites, dollarization, and the destruction of the Central Bank of Argentina. These are kind of like the things that talks to Argentina's problems the most. The amount of bureaucracy, the amount of parasitical activity that exists in the state, the fact that there's absolutely no control over how much money is going to be put into circulation at any times, and the fact that a lot of people who are using dollars, who is kind of like, it is the unofficial currency, the dollar. He wants to make it possible for anyone to have access to it instead of these applied capital controls that has happened because the sitting government realizes that nobody has any respect or belief in the peso, and they want to get exposure to dollars, and they try to control that artificially by putting on capital control. So I think these are the three main points that is really the biggest pain points, and Milei wants to address all of that. And yeah, hopefully he's able to at least do two out of three.
So is his plan to make the US dollar the legal tender in Argentina? Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct.
So basically, he's planning to abolish the central bank, I don't know if that's like a rhetorical thing or is that like real? Because it sounds pretty crazy. Like, hopefully it happens, but I don't know.
He has gone on TV and beaten down a piñata that was in the shape of the central bank. And he has also said, I'm going to put dynamite in the central bank himself. So yeah, let's see. Let's see how literal he means that. But yeah.
Okay. So some Bitcoiners have kind of criticized that. Oh, okay. You know, you're going to the US dollar, which is also just a printed currency. And he's like lowering Argentinian sovereignty by using the US dollar, and these kind of criticisms. And like, what's your take on that?
Well, Bitcoiners who said that, who said stuff like, "Oh, you're just perpetuating the hegemony of the Federal Reserve," they're not wrong, but they're missing out a very crucial point. And maybe they're missing that point because they live in the West and they have a chill currency. You can't continue to live the way Argentinians have lived. I think from 1983, the last 40 years since we ended the last military dictatorship and we have been in so-called democracy, in those 40 years, we've taken 13 zeros out of the peso. So if we were never, and we have like different name changes. We had the Austral, then we went back to the peso, then we had convertibility in the 90s. There was one peso, $1. There's been a lot of experiments throughout these 40 years. And if these experiments had not happened, $1 today would be worth 13 zeros. I don't even know what that number is. A gazillion, maybe? So instead of having $1 being a gazillion pesos today, we now have this new convertibility where it's almost $1 a thousand pesos. All of that, these 13 zeros that we've taken off the peso, is comparable to Venezuela and all these like experiments and all these like Mickey Mousing that they have been doing with their local currency, and see how people live there. Argentina is on that path, and will be if nobody really makes a drastic change. And I don't think a lot of people understand, who live in the West, understand how that type of life is. You can't plan your future, not even the next week. It is crippling. So the US dollar is also a fiat currency that is getting debased and devalued, true, but not at the same rate. And we all understand how important time is and the value of time. What you're essentially doing when you're giving access to the US dollar instead of the Argentine, on relying on the Argentine peso, is you give people time. You give people time to not have to spend all their money right away when they get it, because they don't know how much it's going to be worth the next week. By giving them the opportunity to earn in dollars, well, they can take, and I don't care how much they earn. Let's say they earn $10 dollars a week. Doesn't matter. If they are able to, you know, put away 2-3 of those $10 every week and start saving, and, you know, after 6 months have, you know, $150 that they can spend on a refrigerator or stove oven or any appliances to their house, that is an upgrade. That is deeper than you think, because not only do they have the opportunity to actually save up and plan and expand their time preference a little bit, you also give them the concept of saving to these people. The concept of saving is essential to any human, because you can plan ahead. You can plan your life. You can give yourself time to make decisions and not be desperate all the time. That is way more important than ending the Fed, at least for Argentinians right now. They need to have a more stable currency that they can earn and save in and get out of the Argentine peso, who is a dumpster fire. So a lot of Westerners or Bitcoiners in the West, they have all this hatred against the euro, the dollar, all that stuff, which is totally, I totally agree with. I sympathize with that. But tell that to somebody in Zimbabwe, Venezuela, Argentina, and ask them if they want a dollar right now. They will, of course, they say yes, because it's a more destitute situation that they're in. So anybody who's in the situation will understand the value of a dollar. But somebody who's not, who can chill, who have a nice enough lifestyle and some savings already, yeah, it's easy for them to criticize the US dollar. So that's kind of like the context that a lot of Bitcoiners in the West are missing, which is unfortunate, but at the same time, I do understand where they're coming from. It's a privileged take or whatever. But, you know, hopefully me going on a couple of podcasts and other Argentine Bitcoiners who are vocal about this on Twitter, maybe that can, you know, teach them something new.
What's the inflation in Argentina right now?
142% annually.
Well, okay. 142% annually. Okay. So that's pretty high. So I guess, and from what I'm saying, it's been increasing in the last 3 years. And obviously that's what helped somebody like Javier come to power. And going like more to Bitcoin, do you know what's Milei's, like, has he said anything about Bitcoin? Do you know how much he knows about Bitcoin? And are we going to get Bitcoin adopted as a national currency?
Well, I have a couple of opinions on that. I think Milei understands Bitcoin in a fair way. He has been asked about that in different interviews, where every time he has answered what he thinks about Bitcoin, I feel like I'm pretty comfortable with his answers. He basically says, well, Bitcoin is good because it brings back the concept of private banking. He thinks that money should be in the hands of the people. So Bitcoin essentially is going back to that time where there's different monies available for different things, and ultimately people will choose whatever is the best money. And I totally agree with that as well. But at the same time, though, that same logic that Milei has about Bitcoin can essentially be put to other shitcoins as well, because Ethereum and Monero and whatever is also competition becoming the market the preferred market money, right? So, you know, it's not necessarily a Bitcoin only idea or preference that Milei has. The only difference is he has been specifically asked about Bitcoin, has not been specifically asked about Ethereum or any other stuff. But I do think that if he were to be asked about that, about Ethereum or Monero or any other, you know, alternative coins, he would probably say the same thing. Yeah, it's a private, it's private money. It's good. We need more competition to, you know, to be able to determine what is the best money available. It should be in the private sector's hand, is basically what Milei thinks about it. But since he's been asked about Bitcoin specifically, a lot of Bitcoiners, they listen to these interviews and say, okay, he's a Bitcoiner. And yeah, I think he might like Bitcoin, but I think that's not necessarily something that was part of his political promise, or was not something that he was vocal about in his campaign. I'm going to make Bitcoin legal tender if I get elected. That was nothing at all. So I think a lot of Bitcoiners are very, you know how Bitcoiners get, you know, we get very excited about these things, especially after what we've seen with Bukele and the sorts. But if you really think about it, there's been a lot of politicians around the world who said, yeah, I'm going to make Bitcoin legal tender. You have like politicians in Tonga, Colombia, who came out of the woodwork, Mexican politicians saying the same thing. These people are politicians, so they need popularity. So if they see, like, they see the effects that Bukele has had with the Bitcoin narrative, they want to jump on that train. So, you know, you got to be very wary about what politicians says. I think it's more important that Milei comes into power and is able to make these changes that he wants to make, because if he is able to make these changes, I think he's going to create a foundational structure for Bitcoin to succeed in Argentina. But mind you, I am of the personal belief that adoption is from the bottom up and not the other way around. So it doesn't really matter to me if Bitcoin becomes a legal tender anywhere. I think legal tender status might just, you know, make people more psychologically inclined to not be so risk averse to Bitcoin, perhaps. But ultimately, in Argentina, the Bitcoin adoption is because of a real need. And I think that need is only going to grow bigger. And that's what I hope that can happen, along with just the foundational things getting fixed in Argentina. Then I think Bitcoin really has a great country to really grow in, if that makes sense.
It does. And I completely agree with you. To be honest, yeah, we don't really need Bitcoin to be legal tender or not. Like, I'm very happy with competition. Bring on competition. Mm-hmm. As long as government, all we really need is governments not to stand in the way.
And exactly.
That's all we ask for. That's all we need. Just let us compete. Like, just right. Let us compete. That's all we really need. And to be honest, I'm very confident that if we are allowed to compete on a fair playing field, Bitcoin will win out in the end, because the characteristics of Bitcoin, I believe in them, and I believe Bitcoin will win out in the end because of that. So, but that's all, like, we just need people. To be honest, best thing politicians can do is just not get in the way. And totally. If we do that, I'll be over the moon.
Yeah. And that is what Milei essentially wants to do, right? He wants less state intervention in all of these things. So if he's able to create that, that's my point exactly. If he's able to create that, reduce the state, reduce all these fiscal burdens on its population, then Bitcoin is going to thrive in Argentina more than it already has. I mean, you see Bitcoin stablecoin usage in Argentina is skyrocketed. So you don't need a legal tender to make people see the need. If the need is there, then fine, they're just going to gravitate towards the strongest money compared to their local alternative, which right now is US dollar and Bitcoin. So if US dollar, the fiat money, has capital controls and is very difficult for people to really save in dollars as much as they want, then they're going to look for alternative ways. And that's why stablecoins, that's why Tether is so big in Argentina as well. But that's also why Bitcoin is growing and is big as well. Because if you are in a situation where things are bad and politicians are making it difficult for you to change the situation to be a good one, I think it's human nature for us to look for alternatives and don't really care about whether something has legal tender status or not. You just want to do good for yourself and your family by any means necessary. So, yeah, I think we both align on this.
Well, I mean, it is very exciting and interesting. I think, yeah, like I said, just having somebody with that Austrian economic but philosophy, because that is the Austrian economics is the philosophy behind Bitcoin, and having that become more prominent on the world stage is a win for Bitcoin in itself. So, you know, we were politicians, at the end of the day, we always have to kind of be prepared a little bit for disappointment. I think that's the reality, because even if people have good intentions, the reality of running a country or system is you often can't achieve what you want to get. And that's just kind exactly. of the reality. But, you know, even him winning the election and putting that kind of Austrian economics, that's already doing something. So, you know, hopefully things get better for Argentina and things improve, and hopefully it becomes a win for Bitcoin also, and Bitcoin is allowed to thrive on without governments getting in the way in Argentina, because unfortunately increasingly there seems to be more regulation and governments trying to interfere in United States, but in Australia also, we're going to get some regulation. But more about yourself, is there anything else you want to talk about, or some of the work you're doing, the Bitcoin Perception Index and stuff?
Yeah, happy to say that. And also, just to piggyback on what you just said, going into the Bitcoin perception, because I think there's a connection there. I tweeted about that as well. Like, it's limited to how much change, or at least drastic change, you can do in 4 years in a place like Argentina. Also, when you are part of a system that forces you to compromise and strike deals with the other side of the opposition that are in the Senate and will vote on different things. What I think is the most important thing is exactly what you said, is the narrative, the cultural change, hopefully. Like, he is winning the cultural battle, in my opinion. And the fact that we will have an official, let's say, spokesperson of the country, as in the president, in Javier Milei, that can talk about these things in an official way, hopefully in the 4 years that he will become the largest public figure in Argentina, more people will listen to these ideas and start understanding them. And then hopefully they can be part of that change ultimately that Argentina needs in the next 30 years, to be honest, if we are serious about turning the tide. Even Milei has said that himself. So it's the narrative, it's the stories that is the most important thing, and that is that it gets repeated and propagandized enough so that it sticks and that people start believing in these ideas and want to, like, you know, build a business, be self-sovereign, think about community and all of that stuff. That is the biggest hope that I have for Milei, him becoming president. And that's why I think the work behind Bitcoin Perception is so important at this point, because I think we are in like a very interesting phase of the Bitcoin global adoption cycle, that we start to see the cracks in the biggest mainstream media outlets. There are more journalists that are generally curious about Bitcoin that doesn't come with preconceived notions when they sit down to write about Bitcoin. And I think it's important that we as Bitcoiners know these nuances, because it's very easy for us as Bitcoiners, as a community, to say the mainstream media hates us. They hate Bitcoin because those negative headlines that you see from some outlets are it gets you triggered, right? So it's very easy to remember the bad coverage and not really pay that much attention to the actual coverage from the biggest mainstream media outlets that are balanced and even positive. And more importantly, within these outlets, there are certain journalists who keep a consistent pace of genuine curiosity, open-mindedness, and they're willing to learn and cover Bitcoin in a more balanced way. So that is kind of like what I want to do with Bitcoin Perception. I want to bring that to the Bitcoin community so that people can just distill through a very noisy landscape and see that signal and see that, okay, even though there are perhaps some very specific outlets that are consistently negative about Bitcoin, there's a gap opening. And I think that gap will only widen more as more and more people grow up with Bitcoin. You know, the kids today, they're very crypto-minded. Well, a lot of them will become the journalists of tomorrow. And they will come with a different perception of Bitcoin than somebody who is a Gen Xer today, for example. So I think Bitcoin Perception paints like nice visual charts. I present that to people so they can get a quick snapshot of how things are evolving. And it's a very interesting time that we're in right now in terms of adoption and mass perception of Bitcoin. So I think it's a necessary tool that every Bitcoiner should have these days.
Yeah. And I think something I noticed you tweeted out is that the media perception of Bitcoin and crypto being separate, but that kind of narrative is catching on a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is insane. I think that is something that we've never seen before. And I'm happy I can look at charts and I gather the data to pick up on those things. I think that's a very, very important milestone in Bitcoin's history. And it's happening right now. So having the tools to see these things and see how the narrative shifts for someone is very interesting. And it's also good to see like when really big stories happen, to be able to see, okay, are the majority of mainstream media shifting negative or positive to these big news? And whether we like it or not, the mainstream media, they have a lot of, they have a big audience. They're not physical newspapers anymore. They're also in media. They are on YouTube, they're on Twitter. They have a big reach. So whether you like it or not, they're going to influence a lot of people. And I think if we have a way to track and keep them in check, then I think that's valuable for us moving forward.
Yeah. So I'll put that in the show notes, the perception, so anybody can sign up to that. And I believe it's a free newsletter, right?
Yeah, it's a free report out every week, every Monday. So every Monday you get the last week overview. And I'm also starting to build out the actual tools so that people can log in and, you know, play around with the data themselves and figure out things for themselves for people who want to go a little bit deeper on their own.
Yeah. So I'll put that in the show notes and your Twitter also. We'll put that in the show notes. And is there anything else you want to cover, Fernando?
No, I think that's it. It was a really good convo. Thanks, Dan. Loved your question and I love the back and forth. Hopefully your listeners will learn a little bit more about Argentina, about Milei, and hopefully they can get excited about Argentina's future as much as I am.
Yeah, I think so. I also enjoyed the conversation. I learned a lot of things there. So I hope other people enjoyed it. And yeah, thanks for your time, Fernando. And I hope we'll see each other again, probably at some Bitcoin event. And yeah, enjoy the rest of your day in sunny Spain, I guess. Now, well, it's probably not sunny now. It's like winter there, right? So
yeah, sunny. But you know what? I'm not a big fan of the sun, so this is perfect for me. So I'm enjoying it.
No worries. Okay, cool. Well, anyway, thanks for your time, Fernando, and hope to see you soon.
Awesome. Thank you.